There is a particular in the case of Emma Piggott that makes it different from the other cases. In the other cases, fires broke out in the presence of girls. But, according to evidence, Emma Piggott was not in the house wherein started the fires for which she was accused. Then this seems to be a case of distance ignition, or of distance witchcraft. I'd not say that invisibly starting a fire, at a distance, by means of mental rays, is any more mysterious than is the shooting off of distant explosives by means of rays called physical, which nobody understands. I am bringing out that, as a natural force, there is a fire-inducing power. That, mostly, it appears, independently of wishes, or of the knowledge, of the subjects, but that sometimes, conformably to wishes, it is used. That everything that I call witchcraft is only some special manifestation of transformations, or transportations, that, in various manifestations, are general throughout nature. The accidents on the Dartmoor Road or that somewhere near this road lived a cripple. That his mind had shape to his body or that somewhere near this road lived somebody who had been injured by a motor car, and lay on his bed, or sat in his invalid's chair, and radiated against the nearby road a hate for all motorists, sometimes with a ferocity, or with a directness, that knocked cars to destruction. Or Brooklyn, April 10, 1893. See back to the supposed series of coincidences, man after man injured by falling from a high place, or being struck by a falling object, or that somewhere in Brooklyn was somebody who had been crippled by a fall, and, brooding over what he considered a monstrous injustice that had so singled him out, radiated influences that similarly injured others. See back to the account of what occurred to French aeroplanes, flying over German territory. Tracks in the sands of a desert. Occurrences, about Christmas Day, 1930, in Sing Sing and Dannemora prisons, or a prisoner in a punishment cell and nothing to do in the dark, except to concentrate upon vengefulness. I think that sometimes, coming from dungeons, there are stinks of hates that can be smelled. It was a time that for almost everybody else was a holiday. Tracks that stopped, in a desert, or the tracks of a child that stopped, on a farm, in Brittany, the story of Pauline Picard. Or the hate of a neighbor for the Picards, and vengeance by teleporting their offspring, the finding of Pauline in Cherbourg, again her disappearance. That this time the body of the child was mutilated and stripped, so that it could not be identified, and was transported to some lonely place, where it decomposed. But a change of purpose, or a vengefulness that required that the parents should know transportation to the field, of this body, which probably could not be identified, transportation of the neatly folded clothes, so that it could be identified. In the matter of the two bodies on benches in a Harlem park, I have another datum. I think I have. The dates of June 14th and June 16th are close together, and Mt. Morris Park and Morningside Park are not far apart. Or a man who lived in Harlem, in June, 1931, and that he was a park bencher, about whom I can say nothing except that his trousers were blue, and that his hat was gray. Something may have sapped him, pursued him, driven him into vagrancy. But that he probably had the sense of localization, as to benches, that everybody has in so many ways, such as going to the same seat, or as near as possible to the same seat, upon every visit to a moving picture theater, that every morning he had sat on a particular bench, in Mt. Morris Park. But that, upon the morning of June 14th, because of a whim, suspicion, or intuitive fear, he went to Morningside Park instead. That somebody else sat on his particular bench, that there occurred something that was an intensification of the experiences of John Harding and another man, when crossing Fifth Avenue, at 33rd Street, to the man who was sitting on this particular bench, and to another man upon a nearby bench. But that, 2 days later, the trail of the intended victim was picked up. Home News, Bronx, June 17, 1931. That, in Morningside Park, morning of the 16th, a policeman noticed a man, blue trousers and gray hat, seemingly asleep on a bench. The man was dead. Heart failure. At a time of intensely bitter revolts by coal miners against their hardships, there were many coal explosions, but in grates and stoves, and not in shipments. No finding of dynamite in coal was reported. If in coal there is storage of radiations from the sun, coal may be absorbent to other kinds of radiations or a savagely vengeful miner's hope for future harm in every lump he handled. If, in the house in Hornsey, there were not only coal explosions, but also poltergeist doings, we note that these phenomena occurred only in the presence of the two boys of the household or especially one of these boys. Between the occultism of adolescence and the occultism of lumps of coal, surcharged with hatreds, there may have been rapport that, somewhere near the town of Saltdean, Sussex, September, 1924, somebody hated a shepherd, and stopped the life of him, as have been stopped the motions of motors, and that the place remained surcharged with malign vibrations that affected somebody else, who came along, in a sidecar. The wedding party at Bradford and the gaiety of weddings is sometimes the bubbling of vitriol or that, from a witch, or a wizard, so made by jealousy, mental fumes played upon this house, and spread to other houses. At the same time, there are data that make me think that volumes of deadly gases may be occultly transported. And a young couple, walking along a shore of the Isle of Man that, from a state of jealousy, witchery flung them into the harbor, and that somebody who stepped into the area of this influence was knocked after them. See back to the story of a room in a house in Newton, Massachusetts. See other cases of mass psychology. See a general clearing up. If I can bridge the gap between the subjective and the objective, between what is called the real and what is called the unreal, or between the imaginary and the physical. When, in our philosophy of the hyphen, we think of neither the material nor the immaterial, but of the material immaterial, accentuated one way or the other in all phenomena, when we think of the imaginary, as deriving from material sustenance, or, instead of transforming absolutely, only shifting accentuation, we accept that there is continuity between what is called the real and what is called the unreal, so that a passage from one state to the other is across no real gap, or is no absolute jump. If there is no realness that can be finally set apart from unrealness in phenomenal being, my term of the realization of the imaginary, though a convenience, is a misnomer. Maybe the word transmediumization, meaning the passage of phenomena from one medium of existence to another, is not altogether too awkward, and is long and important enough looking to give me the appearance of really saying something. I mean the imposition of the imaginary upon the physical. I mean, not the action of mind upon matter, but the action of mind-matter upon matter-mind. Theoretically there is no gap. But very much mine are inductive methods. We shall have data. Not that I can more than really unreally mean anything by that. The interpretations will be mine, but the data will be for anybody to form his own opinions upon. Granting that the gap has not been disposed of, inductively, I reduce it to two questions. Can one's mind, as I shall call it, affect one's own body, as I shall call it? If so, that is personal witchcraft, or internal witchcraft. Can one's mind affect the bodies of other persons and other things outside? If so, that is what I shall call external witchcraft. 26. Hates and malices, murderous radiations from human minds. Or the flashes and roars of a thunderstorm. And there has been the equivalence of picking strokes of lightning out of the sky, and harnessing them to a job. A house afire or somebody boils an egg. Devastation or convenience. Or what of it, if I bridge a gap? I take it that the story of Marjorie Quirk is only an extreme instance of cases of internal, or personal, witchcraft that, today, are commonly accepted. London Daily Express, October 3, 1911. Inquest upon the body of Marjorie Quirk, daughter of the Bishop of Sheffield. The girl had been ill of melancholia. In a suicidal impulse she drank, from a cup, what she believed to be paraffin. She was violently sick. She died. There had been no paraffin in the cup. There was no trace of it in her mouth or throat. New York Herald Tribune, January 30, 1932. Boston, January 29. Nearly half a hundred students and physicians living in Vanderbilt Hall of the Harvard Medical School have experienced mild cases of what apparently was paratyphoid, it was learned today. The first 30 of the group fell ill 2 weeks ago, following a fraternity dinner, at which Dr. George H. Bigelow, state health commissioner, discussed food poisoning. A few days later, 20 more men reported themselves ill. The food was prepared at the hall. Today, state health officers started an examination of kitchen help in the belief that one of the employees may be a typhoid carrier. College authorities said they did not believe the food itself was at fault, but were inclined to think the subject of Dr. Bigelow's address may have influenced some of the diners to diagnose mere gastronomic disturbances more seriously. All of the students have recovered. To say that 50 young men had gastronomic disturbances is to say much against conditions of health in the Harvard Medical School. To say that the subject of illness may have induced illness is to say that there was personal, or internal, witchcraft, usually called autosuggestion. See back to Typhoid Mary and other probable victims of carrier finders. To say that there may have been a carrier among the kitchen help is to attribute to him, and is to say that it was only by coincidence that illnesses occurred after a talk upon illnesses. It's a hell of a way, anyway, to have dinner with a lot of young men, and talk to them about food poisoning. Hereafter, Dr. Bigelow may have to buy his own dinners. If he tells shark stories, while bathing, he'll do lonesome swimming.